Mrs. Edgley, reel one.
Well, of course, as I said, we used to travel about. My father's an analytical chemist. And he was the son of the Baptist minister over here. And my mother was the granddaughter of a Baptist minister or missionary, in fact, in Guyana, you see. And when my father went out there, you see, he met her. She was at a school fellow with the governor's wife, and she'd invited her out there for 3 months, you see. And I don't know how the missionary got to see her, but anyway, he fell in love with her, and she decided she would stay. So her father promptly cut her off with the proverbial shilling, because it wasn't the thing to marry a missionary. And then when her father died, when she was a small girl, the grandfather, of course, said, "Oh, he came back again, you see, and said he would be responsible for all her training and that kind of thing." And she went, sent to boarding school and so on, in St. Kitts. And then, when she was about 18, so she finished her, took all her exams and took her teacher's exams, and she went to teach the Archbishop's children, and. Then, as I say, they were on the estate, a sugar estate that belonged to Quintin Hogg, who was the grandfather of the present Lord Hailsham. And he, you know, he started the Polytechnic in London and various things. So when we came eventually to settle in London, my mother wrote to tell him we were there, you see, and he was awfully good. And got my eldest brother into Birkbeck College and so on. And,
how many brothers and sisters did you have?
I didn't have any sisters, but three brothers. And the eldest one is still here in Dartmouth. He went into the post office and he became postmaster of Dartmouth for some years and then retired there, you see. And the second brother, he went into a monastery. He was a sort of a saint, and he really was lovely. And he died 2 years ago there. And the youngest brother is an architect up in Edinburgh. He was 14 years younger than me. So he's just sort of on the borders of retiring now. But this youngest one, he was at the grammar school when the war broke out, and his ambition was to go into the army, as all these boys did. They didn't know what they were letting themselves in for, of course. And he managed to get, he learned to ride a motorcycle and various things, and then he went into the army, and he was the one that was company runner to his general, and taking his general back to his headquarters. When he came back, he found the hut surrounded with Germans, all the rifles at the ready. "Tell me where you've taken your kid general," you see. And he wouldn't. Of course, it didn't matter. You know, those boys were all so enthusiastic and loyal and all the rest of it. But when he had a dreadful time, he eventually got into a camp where they starved them. And one day they found there was no guards on. They all walked out and eventually found himself in hospital in Holland, but he didn't know how he got there. And then eventually, after a lot of people of all kinds, YMCA people and that, going in trying to find out who he was, eventually one thing and another came back, you see. And then, of course, in the Second World War, he volunteered again, and he was a major then, and took the he was a liaison with the Polish paratroopers, and he took I think 600 of them over to Arnhem and brought about 60 back. And they made a film of that and begged him to go in it, you see, because he was the liaison officer, which he did. Now, I remember seeing that film. It was rather interesting.
During the First World War, while he was a prisoner of the Germans, did you know where he was?
No. No idea. No, he was posted as missing. And my mother came to stay with me at the time for a bit. And we couldn't know. We'd no idea where he was. He was missing, you see, and really we didn't anticipate even seeing him again. I remember the day the armistice was proclaimed. I was still with my broken leg and somebody came to tell me. It was getting better then, you see. Somebody came to tell me and we just wondered if there was any chance of ever seeing him. Well, it was quite a long time, about 6 months or more, before we did get him eventually.
Going back to the beginning of the war, you were studying in Nottingham. Did you plan to be a doctor?
No, I knew, you see, that we were going to eventually have a church. And I thought...
Were you already married by that time?
Yes, then. And so my husband, he went to the Nottingham Congregational College, and they used to do a lot of their studies at the university as well, you see. So I thought, well, I might as well fit myself for the sort of leading church work, although I was young, but I felt that I ought to do something, you see. And so I thought, well, I'll study physiology and anatomy, and that would be useful for classes and things like that, and useful altogether in perhaps eventually going out abroad and missionary work or something of that sort. It would be useful, and so that's why I did that, you see. And because we were in that class, they said, oh, well, we must start a... There's war is coming, and we must start a class, a detachment. So that's how we started the detachment, you see.
How long before the war was that?
Well, it was the beginning of the year, 1914, and I became a full member by May 1914. And then, you see, my husband hadn't finished his course yet, and so I thought, well, I might as well join up and do some useful work in the meantime, you see. And his parents had a cottage in the country in Essex, and it was bombed, and so it was a chance. They came to sort of keep house for him, you see, and while I was away.
Were you just going by day to Nottingham?
At the university, you mean?
No, to the Red Cross.
Well, yes, we did our training, you see. We had to do a week every month at the General Hospital. And we used to go for the whole week, you see, into the hospital. And then, of course, we did all sorts of various duties that were there, hospital work and all kinds of duties, accidents, and going to... football meetings and hockey meetings and things like that, and cinemas and so on. You were always somebody or other. You fell down the stairs or fainted or something or other. And we had to do in the hockey matches. We used to have a lot of very nasty accidents. We did all that sort of duty, you see.
Was this sort of training related at all to the work you did after war was declared?
Well, it prepared you, you see. I mean, as I say, they were all emergency things. Then you had to be quick, you see, and learn to distinguish what was bad and what wasn't, and how to treat it and so on, because eventually, of course, you sent them off to hospital. And usually you went with your patient. When the ambulance came, you went with them and saw them. In fact, we used to very often... we'd go to hospital and with this patient, and the nurse would say, well, look, you know bed making a great deal better than I do. Will you make a bed up for this? Certain kinds of beds for certain kinds of cases, you see, and so on. And we used to have to make the beds up and get them into bed and undress them and wash them, ready for the doctor to come.
I didn't realise there was more than one way to make a bed.
Yes, I mean, you see, if perhaps one leg's injured or not, and all kinds of, and body injuries too, and how you have to turn over so that they don't have the doc when the doctor comes. You haven't got miles of sheets and things to turn over, you see, and so on. And placing them perhaps some in an upright position with what they used to call Fowler's position, with three pillows done like that at the back, so that your back went into the gap at the middle, you see.
Three pillows in a triangle.
Two like that.
Yes.
And one at the top for your head, and then you see your back sort of went into that space there. And then you had to put one pillow perhaps under their knees, or have a long bandage. If it was perhaps one foot you had to see to and the other one you didn't, you'd put the bandage around and tie it onto the top of the bed at the top, you see, so to prevent you slipping down all the time. All kinds of devices like that for keeping them upright, not moving them, because some of them wouldn't have to be moved, you see, if you can help it. Oh, yes, quite a lot of whether you put a draw sheet or whether you didn't and so on, and Macintoshes and... Some patients you wouldn't want that for, but others you would, and where you put the Macintosh. And if it was a nasty accident for the leg or something, you'd have to put a full-length one, you see, so that you didn't damage the beds and so on. And proper way of putting, of changing the draw sheet without moving the patient, you see.
How do you do that?
Well, there have to be two of you, and you roll the... roll it up until you've just got enough left to go underneath. Then the one on the other hand, then you sort of go like that, each side of the leg or the your body, you see.
One on each side.
Yes, and slightly lift it up. And the one on the other side pulls this roll. You see, you roll it right up, pulls that roll straight through quickly, and then down your patient goes. You see, then you've got a piece on each side to tuck in then. And that's how you used to change the draw sheet, perhaps. Just roll it up there. And if you could move him a little, you might move him a little to one side and push it under, and then roll the other side and pull it through, you see, with the least bit of movement and so on. And, of course, the more you do it, the more expert you get to it. When there was a new VAD would come on or something of that sort, us older ones that had been there a long time, used to generally put one new one with an old one that, you know, knew the ropes and so on, so that they didn't make faux pas.
You even had bed-making and bed-changing competitions.
Yes, that was why, of course, we had those. So changing the quickest way of changing a sheet, and you'd have experts watching you all the time, seeing how you did it, you see, and how you rolled the draw sheet up, and how you put the Macintosh first, and the Macintosh and the draw sheet together, and then rolled it up. So you only had one movement instead of two.
What was your fastest time?
I've forgotten about draw sheets and that, but I think making the bed was when I won that competition was 3 minutes. And you had to strip the old bed first, you see, and the way you put it on the backs of the chairs and where you put your cushion, your pillows and so on, and how you did it, and then you had to make it. And the 3 minutes with a patient in bed is pretty quick to strip it and make it again.
Yes.
Mm. So we always had plenty of practice, and they were very glad of us in the hospitals because... Well, we could do all that sort of work and save the nurses a lot. You see, they didn't have all these, not these labour-saving things they have nowadays. Of course, we had bed rests, but sometimes you wouldn't have to put a bed rest. You'd have to put your pillows, you see, like that. And now, of course, they had they have these cellophane sort of sheets they make over the bed now, and they make the bed with it, with the whole cellophane sheet nowadays. And surprisingly, sometimes you had, of course, to cover the pillows with a Macintosh and then just have the pillowcase on top. That could easily wash, you see, but it wouldn't damage the... And you had to, very, very often, you had to use your own, of course, you had to use your own judgment, you see, and that, and... risk being called over the coals and a sister came along and if it wasn't right, so on. So you you were glad of the going into hospital and doing a whole week at a time. You see, you've got to know the patients in that ward and what to do without being told and so on. Well, we had some very thorough training beforehand. Nothing like they do nowadays. Of course, they don't have anything like it.